This is PGI. Please stand by. We're about to begin. Good morning and thank you for joining the Hospice New Zealand Palliative Care Lecture Series. Our thanks to Genesis Oncology Trust for their continued sponsorship, which allows us to bring you these lectures. There will be no presenter video during our live meeting session today. You will see the slides only. Please be advised that today's call is being recorded, August the 7th, 2014. I would now like to turn the conference over to your speaker today, Ms. Kate Gibb. Please go ahead.
Good morning, everyone. Thanks for getting out of bed so early to join me. I'm sitting here in my office talking to myself, which all feels a bit weird, but I'm sure there looks like there are a few of you out there somewhere. So firstly, I'd like to thank Mary Schumacher and the team at Hospice New Zealand for this opportunity to speak with you all today, and in particular, Rachel Crombie. Thanks for all of your help, Rachel, as well as the Genesis Oncology Trust for their support of this fabulous lecture series, which I'm really honoured to be a part of, so thank you very much. And I'm going to be speaking this morning about palliative care in residential care settings in New Zealand. So we're going to move to slide two. So I'm going to tell you a little bit about my background and how I came to be speaking with you today, and then I'm going to go on to talk about some context, why we might be interested in palliative care and residential care, and looking at some of the work the Palliative Care Council has been involved in recently around place of death. And I'm aware my colleague Professor Heather McLeod shared some of this with you recently, so it may be somewhat familiar. But we will focus in particular on residential care and some of the implications. And I really could talk about this topic all day, and it feels like this is a real whistle-stop tour in 45 minutes. But at the risk of putting you all to sleep, I'm going to try and touch on what I feel are some really important elements to understand. So I'm going to talk about a little bit about what is residential care in New Zealand, what does the sector look like, who's receiving care and who's providing it, and how have we got to where we are today. And I'd like to then spend a wee moment thinking about some perceptions of aged care and how this might impact on the sector and some of the challenges inherent in practicing in this setting and which impact on care in general, but in particular palliative care of older people, and some of the work which is being done to support the sector and to improve quality of care. And finally, we'll just touch on some of the opportunities for the future which might support the sector to continue to make improvements in providing palliative care, as we do know that the need's only going to increase going forward. So what I think I'm going to do is leave you with more questions than answers, really, and hopefully just give you some food for thought for your different services to consider. So we move to slide three. So just a little bit about me. This is me at the Buller Half Marathon last year. That's not me in the front. That's me in behind, attempting to have a big sprint finish and outrun this older man in front of me, which wasn't successful. He must have heard me coming, and he put on a burst of speed, much to my friend's delight, who were waiting for me at the finish line, as they always get there much sooner than me. But this is one of my favourite photos of what I consider the really lovely image of positive ageing. So I'm the Nursing Director for Older Persons Health for Canterbury and West Coast DHBs, and I'm also a member of the Palliative Care Council. And I represent what's considered the generalist nursing voice on the council, and a particular focus has been the palliative care of older people. So my background prior to my current role was most recently in managing a large rest home hospital and retirement village in Christchurch. And prior to that, I spent some time as a clinical coordinator of another facility. And I've worked all of my adult life with older people, from starting as a caregiver when I was 19. And because I took sort of the long way around with my nursing training and I took some time out along the way, I spent 8 years as a caregiver in aged residential care altogether. So the sector's really special to me, and care of older people is something I'm really, really passionate about, and in particular, palliative care of older people and ensuring they have equitable access to care regardless of setting. Slide four. So to start with, I'd like to think a little bit about what do we know and why do we care? Well, we know that our population's ageing. The population over 65 has increased already to 13%, and it's expected to reach 21% by 2031. Now, this isn't new news, but I sometimes wonder whether we're almost getting a little desensitized to this information by now. And we hear the words ageing population, and I wonder if our eyes start to glaze over to a certain extent. But this is real, and it is pressing, and it is beginning to have an impact on our services now, already. We're already seeing the impact of this. Slide 5. As we know, in order to manage this and the resources that will be required to support the needs of older people within our health system, the direction of travel is to move towards a model of care provision which is closer to home, with increased reliance on primary care to support people in the home, and avoidance of unnecessary transfer to acute services. So this slide shows the allocation of resources or dollars across our health system with a clear downward trend in deployment of resources to hospital care and an increase to prevention, to long-term conditions management and avoidance of hospital admissions, which is represented by the arrows moving towards the black line as the future state. Slide 6. A number of you will be familiar with the Palliative Care Council's needs assessment work. So the Phase 1 report, which was released in 2011, looked at assessing what might be the level of need for palliative care in New Zealand. And among other things, this told us that approximately 1 in 20 people over 65 are living in aged residential care, and that over 40% of those over 85 who died from a condition which might have been amenable to palliative care died in aged residential care. The Phase 2 report, which was released in 2013, identified that there was more work to be done in terms of understanding this better, and there was a real limitation in what data was available about the extent of palliative care being delivered. And understanding, based on some really comprehensive New Zealand research, including the OPAL study that we'll touch on later, that overall dependency is increasing, and a sense that increasingly aged residential care is being utilised as a setting for end-of-life care on discharge from acute hospital settings. So with this in mind, currently the Council's working on a project to examine this a little further, and we're hopeful that we'll have a report to the Minister by mid-2015. Slide 7. So from a palliative care perspective particularly, in thinking about service planning moving into the future and how best to focus our efforts, it's helpful to not only consider what we know about our ageing population, as we touched on a moment ago, but also what we know about deaths in New Zealand historically and currently, and then projections about deaths going forward. So for those of you who were fortunate enough to listen to my colleague Heather McLeod from the Palliative Care Council present in this series in June, you may be familiar with some of this work, but I just think it's important to touch on it again briefly here. Heather's expanded on the needs assessment work to do a really comprehensive analysis of mortality data from 2000 to 2010, and the findings are really quite striking. So from 2000 to 2010, 30% of all deaths were of people over 85 years, which is represented by the dark blue area on the graph. The lighter blue represents those 75 to 84, which are a further 30%. Slide 8. However, as we can see from this projection, deaths in the oldest age band, so over 85 years, which is again here the dark blue area on the graph, will increase dramatically over the coming years. This projection takes us out to 2060. The marked area on the graph relates to the period 2010 to 2025. And this is, of course, what we could think about as being the pointy end of our ageing population. Ageing clearly has an impact on dying in terms of the presence of disease and disease trajectories, and how then services might need to respond. And this increase in deaths at older ages is clearly something we're going to need to give some consideration to. Slide 9. So this slide looks at the different trajectories that might be experienced at the end of life in terms of the impact on function and decline over time. Trajectory 1 at the top of the slide is characterised by a short period of evident decline over weeks or months. There might be good function maintained for quite some time, with a few weeks or months of rapid decline as the illness progresses towards death. Now, generally, there's time to anticipate needs and plan for future for end-of-life care. And this pattern's typical of the many of the major cancers, for example. About 20% of people follow this trajectory at the end of life. Trajectory 2 is characterised by long-term limitation of function with intermittent, severe, acute episodes or dips. Patients with heart failure or chronic obstructive pulmonary disease are usually ill for many years, through which time they experience frequent acute exacerbation of symptoms, which are often associated with acute hospital admission and treatment, and a return to more or less similar level of function if the acute exacerbation is survived, although function continues to progressively decline over time. Now, this pattern can be occurring over a number of years, making it difficult to know when to expect death through that period. And about 25% of people follow this trajectory. For those who reach advanced age and without experiencing cancer or organ failure, it's likely they'll die of either dementia or generalized frailty. And this trajectory is characterized by progressive disability and decline, or a prolonged dwindling, where reserves are already low. Gradual decline in functional capacity combined with the impact of often quite minor physical events like a fall or a respiratory or a urinary infection can then prove fatal. And approximately 40% of people will follow this trajectory. And the three characteristic trajectories are roughly sequential in terms of age, with the first trajectory relating largely to cancer peaking at around 65 years, fatal chronic organ system failure represented in the second trajectory about a decade later, and frailty and dementia trajectory 3 afflicting those who live past their mid-80s. Slide 10. So the implications then for palliative care services of this pattern of older deaths over time is that along with an increase in the numbers of deaths, these will be of people in older age bands. This means they'll be caring for people with a higher burden of disease and comorbidity and a high prevalence of dementia. And as we know that there will be more deaths in the over 85 year group, most of these deaths will be occurring in residential aged care. Slide 11. What then is residential care in New Zealand? And the sector is often referred to really generically as rest home care. So referred to in the media, for example, as someone being from a rest home. Well, there are four different types of aged residential care services in New Zealand. There's rest home care, hospital level care, specialist dementia, and psychogeriatric services. And broadly speaking, rest home care is for residents with lower levels of dependency who may need assistance with some elements of their activities of daily living throughout the day, but who in general can have their needs safely met without 24-hour nursing presence. For example, evenings and weekends, care may be provided by caregivers only. Hospital-level care for residents with higher dependency needs who may need maximal assistance from one or two staff for most activities and who require 24-hour nursing oversight. Specialist dementia care, which back in my day was referred to as D3 care, is essentially rest home level of care for people who have a safety need, which means general rest home care may not be appropriate, so wandering, for example. Psychogeriatric, or what used to be referred to as D6 or hospital level dementia care, is for those who may have significant behavioural challenges and care needs which are unable to be safely met in a general hospital care setting. And it's important to note here that there is some discomfort with the term hospital level care and a feeling that this doesn't well represent the level of care being provided. In Australia, for example, services are referred to as low care and high care. Hospital level care, for example, doesn't mean that there's medical support on site 24 hours, which can sometimes cause confusion. And there are also varying models around the country where facilities might be specifically contracted to provide end-of-life care. In Canterbury, for example, we have a support care contract, which some facilities hold with the DHB, where there's specific funding available for end-of-life care, where the expected prognosis on admission is less than 3 months. And this model sits alongside and within the usual hospital level care within those facilities and isn't funded any differently in terms of the facility, but it does take away any concern about asset testing and whether an individual may be required to meet the cost of their care privately. Slide 12. Back in 2010, a major review of aged care services was commissioned jointly by DHB Shared Services and the Aged Care Association. And it's referred to as the Grant Thornton Review. And the left-hand graph from that review shows the mix of facilities across New Zealand as at 2009. And we can see that at that point in time, 48% of facilities offered a combination of services, for example, rest home and hospital level care, 36% a standalone rest home facilities. That means that while care must be provided under the direction and delegation of a registered nurse, it's not mandatory for a registered nurse to be on site at all times. For those facilities with a combination of services, often the registered nursing input in the hospital area of the service might be shared with the rest home service out of hours. The graph on the right represents the makeup of the beds themselves across New Zealand as opposed to the facilities. And we can see that at that point in time, the majority of beds in the sector were providing rest home level care, 52%, with 34% of beds at hospital level. Slide 13. So as at January of this year, the Ministry of Health tells us that we have 36,100 beds within the aged residential care sector. So we can see this is a pretty substantial part of our health system, with a huge number of interactions happening with older people on a daily basis around New Zealand. So it was originally the domain of the public health system, but residential care has increasingly been provided by the private sector since the 50s. Progressively, the private sector was encouraged and incentivised to become involved in care delivery, as it was recognised that it was unaffordable for the health system, public health system, to continue to manage long-term care. And the late 80s saw the last long-stay residents of public hospitals transferred to aged residential care facilities. Initially, this was largely via not-for-profit religious and welfare organisations, and these continue to represent 32% of the sector today. There does continue to be some long-term care provision by DHBs, but it's on a very small scale. So, for example, only 0.4% of care provision in the Auckland region in 2009. 37% of facilities are co-located with retirement villages, which operate under an entirely different model and offer independent living. With our changing models of care to strengthen supports for people living independently in the community, as we mentioned a moment ago, we are seeing an increase in the age at which people are admitted to residential care. And in 1988, the median age was 79 years. This was 83 years in 2008. Slide 14. So what do we know about our aged residential care population? Probably our best data comes from what's referred to as the OPAL study, or the Older Persons Ability Level Study, which looked at older people across three DHBs in the Auckland region between 1988 and 2008, and it compared data collected in 1988, 1998 and 2008. And this wasn't a study of the whole of New Zealand, but the Auckland region does represent one third of the population. So the OPAL study's findings have told us a really interesting story about the changing face of aged residential care. Slide 15. The implications of the OPAL study findings are really significant, and what we see is an increasing need for hospital care. The ratio has changed really significantly over this 20-year period. In 1988, 23% of beds were at hospital level compared with 71% rest home, while in 2008, 40% were at hospital level compared with 60% rest home. So from some further analysis of the same data, which was completed in 2011, as we saw on a previous slide, the median age at admission increased with each survey from 79 years in 1988 to 83 years old in 2008. And in 2008, nearly 17% of residents were admitted when aged over 90, compared to just 9% in 1988. And of those admitted within just the 6 months prior to the survey, the median age of admission was even higher again at 85 years. So it seems to be representative of a continuing trend to admit people at increasingly older age. And I don't have any more recent data, but anecdotally I'd suggest that this has continued and the median age of admission currently would likely be higher again. So the length of stay has also been decreasing. And in 2008, 19% of residents had been in ARC longer than 4 years, which was less than any other time point. And stays under 3 months were recorded for 11% of residents in 1988 and 13% in 2008. Now, the Aged Care Association says that the average length of stay in 2012 was around a year at rest home level and 6 months at hospital level. Slide 16. So we're also seeing increased dependency across a range of needs, and again, the impact of these changes is really significant. The proportion of residents within facilities who are bedbound, the level of memory loss, confusion and disorientation, urinary and fecal incontinence, nighttime assistance, All of these have increased through this period. And these issues obviously required increased staffing input and time to support the residents and show an increasing demand on caregivers, which is compounded by shorter length of stay. It's likely that shorter length of stay means residents are already increasingly frail on admission. So from the perspective of caregiver burden, the longer a resident is in care, the more staff get to know their needs and those little things that make a big difference for that person. Shorter length of stay means quite a different perspective on that long-term relationship, long-term care relationship over time. It's really clear that once people enter residential care, they're highly likely to already have a life-limiting illness, so already have a need for palliative care. Slide 17. So now going back to palliative care and aged residential care, what the needs assessment work did tell us is this, that 31% of all deaths are in aged residential care, and for people over 65 years, this is 38%. And this work also tells us something interesting about what happens as people get older and their health deteriorates. And while we know that people tend to want to stay in their own home, as people become increasingly unwell, often with increasing age, it can feel more secure to be in care. So for over 85 years, the vast majority of deaths are in ARC. On the lower of these two graphs, the pink area represents deaths in aged residential care, with the vertical axis showing age and the horizontal showing percentage of deaths. But the light blue area, the bulk of the graph, represents death in hospital settings. Orange is home and the greenish tinged area is hospice settings. The marked area on the graph represents over 65s, and the patterns of increasing deaths in aged residential care with advancing age is really clear. Now this is largely quite intuitive. We understand that this is a role that aged residential care plays in our health system. But I do wonder whether we've underestimated the extent of this. And in the context of our changing model of care and the drivers to support people in their home for longer, as people age and become more unwell, frequently residential care is their preferred home. And aging in place means caring for people in their community, in the home of their choosing. And for many, this is residential care. Slide 18. So I'm just going to spend a few moments taking a further look at some of the analysis of deaths from 2000 to 2010 that my colleague Heather McLeod from the Palliative Care Council has completed. And again, for those of you who were able to listen to her lecture in June, you will have seen these slides before, so please just bear with me for a few moments, as I think it's quite important to just examine this further in terms of why this issue is as important as I believe it is, both to palliative care services, but also actually to society as a whole. This slide shows place of death between 2000 and 2010, and we can see that, as we noted a moment ago, 31% of all deaths over that period were in aged residential care. And you'll see that this data shows that deaths in hospice inpatient units account for only 6% of deaths, but we do know that the extent of hospice involvement is far broader than inpatient services alone. So with slide 19, we can see from the dotted area on the graph that there has been hospice support present across other settings, which we would absolutely recognise. So for aged residential care, for example, we can see that 6.6% of deaths through this period occurred in aged residential care with some level of support from hospice services. So approximately a fifth of deaths in aged residential care may have also had some level of input and support from hospice services. Slide 20. What we can see when we look at this data over time is a pattern of decreasing deaths in public hospitals while increasing in aged residential care, where the dark blue line represents hospital and the green again represents aged residential care. And this may reflect increased discharges from hospital at the end of life, where once people may have remained in hospital and been cared for there during that time. And certainly anecdotally, having managed a facility which received admissions for end-of-life care under the support care contract we mentioned briefly earlier, it was not at all unheard of for residents to be admitted from public hospital settings and pass away within days, and certainly within weeks of admission. Now, Michael Connolly and Joanna Broad and colleagues from Auckland University and some work published last year found that of those admitted to hospital-level care from an acute hospital, mortality was 6.7% at 1 week, 10.6% at 2 weeks, 16% at 1 month, and 36.5% at 6 months. So they argue that it's possible that public hospitals might be transferring responsibility for end-of-life care. Slide 21. Now this is where I think we start to see some really interesting patterns emerging. And this slide shows us the pattern of male deaths over time. And we can see that for men, the most common place of death through this period was hospital and home, which is represented by the yellow line, followed closely by aged residential care. Slide 22. However, for female deaths through this period, we begin to see a really different pattern emerging, and residential care was the most common place of death for females between 2000 and 2010. And remembering that this is analysis of all deaths, not just over 65s. The deaths at home and in hospital settings played a much less significant role in female deaths through this period. And there are many factors which impact on place of death, as we touched on earlier, not the least of which being availability of informal support, such as a spouse at home, life expectancy, and death at younger ages is clearly a factor here too. But what we do see is that 59% of deaths at home are men, but only 39% of deaths in residential care are men. Or to put this in reverse, 61% of deaths in residential care are women, while only 41% of deaths in the home are women. Slide 23. So again, we touched on this point earlier, but for those over 85 years, 55% of deaths are in aged residential care, while with only 10% at home. And it's thought too that a further 10% of deaths in public hospitals are of residents in of aged residential care who have been transferred to acute services. Over this period, 30% of all deaths are over age 85, but again, there are substantial differences between men and women. And it was found that 40% of female deaths are over 85, while only 21% of male deaths are in that age band. So male deaths tend to occur at younger ages, with the largest band being deaths between age 75 and 84, which does seem to have an impact, as we mentioned in the last slide, on place of death for men. Slide 24. So just to cut this data in one further direction, it's also interesting to consider place of death in light of diagnosis. And again, the green area on the graph represents aged residential care. Dark blue is hospital. The yellowish tinge here is private residence. And the red is hospice and patient unit. And we can see some clear differences in terms of cause of death across settings, with the hospice inpatient unit being the most significant setting for cancers, excuse me, and aged residential care being the most significant place of death for conditions which could be classed as mental, behavioural and nervous system conditions. So dementia clearly plays a significant role here, with residential care being the most notable place of death in dementia. So, we know that aged residential care is the most common place of death for women, for those over 85 years, and for those with dementia. It's quite clear then that we could expect a quite different end-of-life care setting then for, say, a 55-year-old man dying of cancer and an 87-year-old woman dying with dementia. Slide 25. We'll go back then briefly to what is aged residential care, and touch on staffing very briefly. Excuse me. This data again comes from the Grant Thornton Review, and it shows the makeup of the sector in terms of numbers of staff in each category per 100 beds, with groupings at the top of each segment. So, for example, we have roughly 11 staff per 100 residents who'd be considered nurses or managers, and 52 staff who'd be considered caregivers or others. Caregivers themselves are by far the largest group. The review found that in terms of hours per resident per week, in rest home care, nursing hours range from 2.3 to 2.9 hours per resident per week, in hospital care from 6 to 7 hours, while for caregivers, this was 10 to 11 hours per resident per week in rest home level care, through to 17 to 18 hours a week at hospital level. A really big proportion of the workforce is part-time, with a third of nursing FTE part-time and two-thirds of caregivers. And there's also high turnover, with turnover of 32% for care staff and 25% for non-care staff. The nursing workforce itself is more stable, with 75% employed by the same employer for more than 4 years, compared with only 50% of caregivers. The workforce is also really increasingly culturally diverse, which brings its own challenges in terms of caring for residents with cognitive impairment and communication difficulties. Slide 26. This slide shows data taken from the Palliative Care Council's Phase 2 Needs Assessment Report, which looked at mapping the hospice response to survey questions around capability with the work Hospice New Zealand did alongside the Ministry of Health Resource and Capability Framework. So Hospice identified three different categories of hospice service and then outlined what would be expected to be provided under each of these categories. Now, again, we well understand that hospice services are far broader than inpatient units, and it's really important to distinguish this. This slide shows the clinical functions which would be provided as well as the roles within hospice services. And I'm focusing here on comprehensive hospice services, which encompass inpatient as well as significant support functions to other care settings across the community. And what we can see from the responses provided, that 100% of comprehensive hospice palliative care service have registered nurses, medical officers or GPs, and spiritual care roles, as well as a volunteer workforce. And the majority also have social work, counselling, and cultural advisor roles within their service. And I offer this slide not to draw any direct comparison between hospice, inpatient units, and aged residential care, as clearly they have an entirely different function and purpose and offer an entirely different model of care, and there should be no straightforward comparison drawn. But we can see some really stark differences in terms of level of registered nursing involvement in care of the dying between aged residential care and inpatient hospice settings, in access to and availability of medical support, and in the availability of other skilled members of the team. Slide 27. Aged residential care also has an ageing workforce, and this slide shows the age profile of the workforce as a whole, and it's clearly skewed to the right, with the majority of staff in older age groups. From a nursing perspective, this is even more significant. Half of nurses working in aged residential care are over 50 years old, and 25 are over 60. 25%, I should say, are over 60. Slide 28. The access to GP support can be quite a challenge for aged residential care, and in particular, timely access to medical care after hours. And in the OPAL study, only 45% of facilities reported they have a GP available on call 24 hours a day. Further, 24% said they had limited GP on call services that were only available until late evening, and they had other arrangements for medical care after those hours. The largest majority of facilities that didn't have after hours services used the service of a locum GP visiting service. So in addition to regular medical cover, 27% of facilities reported using more than one arrangement after hours. And the most frequently reported secondary services was that locum GP after hours service. But public emergency departments and private access and emergency departments were also used. So in addition to the changing demands on aged residential care, primary care teams themselves are also facing increasing demands and a changing profile of the GP workforce, with an ageing GP workforce, but also at the same time, an increase in a younger workforce with family commitments and a different sense of willingness or ability to be available outside practice hours. And this can have a significant impact on the ability to get medical support we needed to aged residential care. Where care is available via a locum after hours service, it can be challenging for even those services to respond promptly with a home visit. And then it's by a GP who doesn't know the residents. Frequently, requests for a home visit can be met with instructions to instead send the resident to ED. Availability of pharmacy after hours is also quite variable, and for facilities in a remote or more rural location, this can mean significant delays in being able to access prescribed medication in the event of any changes or deterioration after hours. So amidst all of these challenges and contextual issues, we continue to have a community who still requires aged residential care, and some fairly fixed and widely held beliefs and perceptions. People don't generally visit or spend time in a facility until they have a reason to. So a significant proportion of the general public haven't had any experience with aged care personally. Slide 30. Now this is just a random selection of headlines collected over the last little while from various New Zealand online media. And as is typical of headlines, the headlines themselves often don't match the text of the article, But it's pretty clear that there's a feeling that negative press about residential care makes for a good headline from a media perspective. And the last quote is one I find particularly demeaning to older people themselves who are in care. Now, one wonderful counter to this lately has been a video which has gone viral from one of our villages in Christchurch, where residents have done a remake of Pharrell's Happy music video, and it's just amazing. Pharrell himself's actually seen it, and he loved it, and he's retweeted it. And if you haven't seen it, you need to. It's called 80-something Years of Happy, and it's retirement village residents, residential care residents, and staff all involved, and it's just wonderful. Slide 31. So the New Zealand Aged Care Association commissioned a telephone survey through Colmar Brunton in 2010 with some really interesting findings in terms of perception of aged care. A third had experience with the sector, and in general it found that those with experience were much more favourable than those without experience. 6 in 10 felt that had experience with the sector felt it was better than how it was presented in the news media. And interestingly, 17% of those with no direct experience thought rest home and aged residential care facilities had worsened over the previous 3 years. Slide 32. What we have then is what could be considered a pretty marginalised sector. The Human Rights Commission conducted a major inquiry into the sector in 2012, and it released this report, Care and Counts. The report states, and I'm quoting here, the decision to hold this inquiry was prompted by two significant concerns. The first relates to the low pay, the undervaluing and the pay disparity for many thousands of New Zealanders, the vast majority of the women working in the aged care sector. The second relates to the nexus between the value society places on the aged care workforce and on the respect and dignity of older New Zealanders. The inquiry came out with some pretty strong findings and recommendations. And it said, low wages and pay inequality and inequity are three issues which dominated the inquiry. The fact that thousands of mainly women are caring for vulnerable older people for barely the minimum wage is an injustice grounded in historical undervaluation of the role. It's an indignity New Zealand can no longer afford. Pay inequality between home and residential-based caring and those doing much the same work in public hospitals cannot continue to be condoned when it's publicly funded. Quite simply, it's a fundamental breach of human rights. So the inquiry draws a really clear line between the rights of the aged care workforce and the rights of older people receiving the service. And it refers to the United Nations Principles for Older People, as well as the UN Convention on the Rights of People with Disabilities. And it says that care of the same standard must be provided to people with disabilities as to others. And this concern about caregiver wages and the impact of pay and conditions on quality of care isn't specific to New Zealand. And the Joseph Rowntree Foundation in the UK has recently published some really interesting work around this area. And they looked at quality of care as expressed by those receiving the service. And what they found was while pay does have an impact, what was also really important was making people feel valued, as well as a positive organisational culture with managerial support and a chance for progression. And they found that similarly to New Zealand, while carers may not have formal qualifications, they do have certain soft skills and personal characteristics and a sense of commitment to older people. And despite the low pay and the low status, they're often motivated to stay in the sector. So even while they may move employers, they stay within aged care. And understanding this is really important, as there can be a real tension between management expectations about efficiency and productivity and the relationships which motivate carers to remain in the role. And in aged care, where continuity of care is so important, retention potentially has a really big impact on care quality. Slide 33. So inappropriate hospitalisation is often something that's talked about when we talked about quality of palliative care and aged residential care. And I want to just briefly share a scenario from practice which might help to explore this a little further. A resident with advanced dementia who'd lived at the care facility for a number of years was appearing unwell one morning. She had no close relatives, but she did have a distant relative who lived some distance away but was rarely in contact. The nurses observed that although there appeared to be no outward signs of infection, constipation or serious illness, the staff that had cared for her for a number of years said they felt instinctively that they knew something was wrong. And on reflection later, they were able to identify that what they'd observed were quite subtle changes in the resident's facial expression, her tone of limbs, and level of responsiveness. And the concerns expressed by the nursing staff led them to suspect that it was possible that she developed a bronchopneumonia and she was potentially in a palliative phase. So as per the usual practice, a visit from the GP was requested by the nurse in charge. When the GP visited, she noted a lack of obvious physiological signs, such as a raised temp, and felt that there was no significant issue to address at that time. However, the resident's condition deteriorated further in the evening, and without a definite diagnosis or a plan in place from the earlier visit, the nursing staff felt it was necessary to call for another visit from the GP. However, unfortunately, due to the time of day, this was provided by the out-of-hours service, who weren't familiar with the resident and her condition. When that doctor visited, he decided immediately to transfer her to hospital, despite the nursing staff on duty feeling strongly that this wasn't the right thing to do. They felt that as the resident was nearing the end of her life, she'd be better cared for in a quiet and dignified way at the facility. But the doctor felt that the acute admission was appropriate and arranged for the ambulance. So the ambulance didn't arrive till quite some time later. A carer accompanied the resident into ED, and by this stage her condition had deteriorated quite significantly. The events in ED had a really lasting impact on the caregiver, who reported how the fragile and confused lady was restrained to allow for blood tests and investigations, and she died shortly afterwards on a trolley in ED, but with her familiar caregiver with her. All the staff within the home, but especially the nurses and the caregivers, felt really sad, really frustrated, and really angry about the circumstances surrounding the end-of-life care for this resident. And this was sadly compounded by an email from the ED consultant to the manager expressing concern about the habit of rest homes sending residents to hospital to die. Slide 34. So what are the underlying issues that might lead to inappropriate hospitalisation? The Christchurch study in 2011 of acute admissions with a prospective cohort of 50 patients admitted from aged residential care found that 22% of those patients died during admission, and 20% of those patients had been already deteriorating and expected to die. 20% of admissions from aged residential care over that period under study could have been appropriately managed in the community. And they found that for some, acute admission was very appropriate, and failing to have done so would have represented poor care. But for those whose admissions were considered avoidable, it was felt there were a group who were dying and who would have benefited from palliative care within the aged care facility, along with others who weren't dying and whose needs could have been met by primary care. Now, as in the case study we just spoke about, in the cases of residents who are admitted to acute services when they are dying and who would clearly have benefited from symptom management and end-of-life care within the facility rather than a hospital admission, there are a number of underlying issues which can lead to this situation. Not the least of these can be access to after-hours medical support, and a model which frequently sees support being provided by someone unfamiliar to the resident at that time. The absence of obvious physiological changes can make diagnosis really complex in older people as well, particularly in the presence of dementia. And nursing staff assessment can often rely on those subtle changes, which can be quite difficult to articulate in a way that other clinicians hear and understand. And on top of all of this, we continue to have a society which has some long-held beliefs about the role of the hospital. So sometimes, despite the very best in communication and planning, in the event of what may be a health crisis and the threat of dying, sometimes all a resident's family will accept for their loved one is a hospital admission. So what might make a difference here? Well, knowing what a resident wants in terms of their future care and ensuring that that's clear, credible and visible. Recognition and anticipation of potential problems, early intervention and confidence of nursing staff when they're communicating with other members of the wider team. A willingness to act as an advocate for residents when that's required. Confident staff are able to challenge plans when they feel they aren't in the resident's best interests. So to recap, it could be considered that what we have here is a bit of a burning platform. We have an ageing population, a need for care which we know is going to increase, increasing dependency and a decreased length of stay. Aged residential care is the most common place of death for women, for over 85s and for people with dementia. There's less time to establish relationships and trust with residents and families who've been under significant stress during acute illness and often a prolonged period of managing quite tenuously at home. They then enter aged care with pre-existing perceptions and beliefs about the likely standard of care. and long-held beliefs around the role of the acute hospital and a medical model which aims to cure disease and prolong life in many cases. Slide 37. So what might be some ways forward? And as I said at the beginning, this feels like a real whistle-stop tour. There's a lot happening in this space. But really my aim is to just give you some food for thought as to what this all might mean for you and your community and in your services. So I'm only able to briefly touch on some current innovations and opportunities and acknowledging that I'm really not doing much justice to a lot of really good work being done. So the first innovation which has had the potential to really support the sector in end-of-life care has been the implementation of integrated care pathway. And the LCP had really been embraced by the sector, and some recent work, which not yet released but been completed as part of a review post-LCP in trying to establish where to from here for New Zealand, found that facilities felt that the use of the LCP supported planning and management of care, documentation, communication, medication management and supporting a holistic approach. As we know, until this work's completed and a new model of care is found that will fit the New Zealand setting, the LCP's still in use, and it's largely considered to be working well, underpinned, of course, by education and ongoing training. There's also some really exciting models around the country, in the Horowhenua district and in Southland, for example, where nurse practitioners are employed to provide support directly into aged residential care facilities. Advanced care planning clearly has the potential to make a significant impact on palliative care and aged residential care. And we're really fortunate that a lot of work's being done in this space. And with recent developments like fully funded places being made available, which will hopefully increase the uptake of training in aged residential care, this is really exciting. So you'll all be familiar, I hope, with the Hospice New Zealand Fundamentals of Palliative Care program. And this is a great example of tailored training and education. And it's also a means of building that relationship between the specialist services and the facilities. The Interi Needs Assessment tool also, I think, offers us an opportunity for the future in terms of palliative care and aged residential care. The Interi is a comprehensive assessment tool which is now mandated to be completed for all people entering care. The standard home care assessment and the long-term care assessment tools don't quite fit the needs, though, for someone who's for palliative care. The risks and protocols for care which are generated through the assessment don't take into account the different priorities of the care when someone's dying. But there is a palliative care assessment tool, which focuses instead on assessment and symptoms and appropriate supportive management, and work's beginning on looking at piloting the use of this tool in a couple of sites around New Zealand. Slide 38. The linkage is not only between palliative care and aged residential care, but also between palliative care and older person's health specialist services are, I think, really important. And at the heart of care of the older person is not only promoting quality of life, but quality of care at the end of life. And these relationships and mutual supports are important going forward. And with this in mind, some work we could consider is the work that's been done in Australia on developing a guideline for a palliative approach to aged care. And this work really values the importance of advanced care planning and ensuring an ethical approach in the presence of chronic disease. And as we mentioned earlier, given what we know about our aged care population as older and increasingly frail, a palliative approach to aged care seems increasingly appropriate. We could also give some consideration to standards and quality indicators for palliative care and aged residential care. And Hospice New Zealand's done some fantastic work on standards within that setting, which might give us some opportunities for considering how these could apply to the aged care sector. And I've recently become aware also of some work being done in Wellington on quality indicators for palliative care and aged residential care, which I'm really excited to find out some more about. So this is our framework for integrated care from the Ministry of Health's Resource and Capability Framework. And just briefly touching on this, but it is underpinned by a number of principles, not least of which is that palliative care will be provided according to need in a seamless manner, regardless of setting, diagnosis or location. Specialist palliative care services will target their direct care service provision at those patients, families and whānau with complex needs that cannot be met or met alone by primary care provider, palliative care providers. So your support of aged residential care is so important in ensuring that older people receive equitable access to palliative care regardless of whether the home they live in now is a residential care facility or the house next door. And in the meantime, work's going on to support and strengthen the older person's nursing workforce more generally in a number of ways, which I could spend another hour talking about. But at the heart of this work is positively promoting and valuing the role of the RN in aged residential care, and the fact that there are wonderful career opportunities in aged residential care. Staff who are valued, who have had education and training so that they're confident in their clinical assessment skills and able to articulate their findings and the rationale for their decision making in a way that other clinicians will respect, make for confident staff who are able to challenge and advocate for their residents. Slide 41. Just finally, I'd like to briefly acknowledge the team at Nurse Maud Hospice, who are hopefully tuned in right now, as well as the team at Nurse Maud Memorial Hospital, who probably aren't tuned in right now. So for those of you who don't know, the hospice is co-located with Nurse Maud's Aged Residential Care Service, and I worked there many years ago as a caregiver. And in June, after attending one of these lectures, I left, and as I walked out through the dining room area, I bumped into two of the caregivers I worked with all those years ago. And when I started there 14 years ago, they were there. And when I left 10 years ago, they were there, and they're still there now. And they are the heart and soul of residential care, and they absolutely inspire me. And despite all of the challenges, there are so many really good people doing really good things and providing really good care. And my hope is that we can continue to support improvements within our system to support them to do what they do best, which is care for people. Thank you.